Hello and welcome to the SRA podcast. Today we have a special interview with a bit of an expanded commentariat. So say hello to Austin, Rowdy, and Ellie.
Hi. Hello.
Hello, I'm Rowdy.
I'm Ellie.
You know me. I'm Austin.
Awesome. So today we have a bit larger panel to talk about the broad array of strikes and labor actions happening around the United States and to some extent the world right now. The month of September in particular has been extremely busy. We've had the climate strike mobilizing 4 million people around the world, especially students, to go out and protest against the lack of action on climate change. We also have strikes in the mining sector, in healthcare, in retail and grocery stores, and also in some industrial sectors. Labor all across America seems like it's starting to rise up and flex a little bit in the face of all these ridiculous wealth inequality and the amount of money going to CEOs and stock buybacks, while most people in America haven't seen a raise in decades.
Yeah, it's nice to finally see some kind of mass action that people in our circles have been kind of calling for a really long time. It's especially inspiring when an activist like Greta Thunberg can go from like being a sole activist to being a part of a crowd of millions and stuff. It's cool. It's pretty inspiring to see that kind of progression take place. But at the same time, we have to keep in mind that natives have been protesting this shit for a really long time without nearly the coverage or nearly the amount of action. So I think it's important that the movement maintains momentum and probably don't go back to work on Monday. Probably just keep striking.
So just to go over some of the numbers from the climate strikes, there were approximately 250,000 people hitting the streets in New York City, where 1.1 million students were excused to allow them to participate. There were also 270,000 in Berlin, 100,000 in London, and about 100,000 in Melbourne, as well as 40,000 in San Francisco, 7,500 in Boston, 3,000 in Chicago, and 2,000 in Portland. Now, in Portland has been this very contentious front in the, I guess you could call it the culture war. It's, you know, obviously with all the fascist and anti-fascist organizing in that area. And so when some of the students who participated in the strike there chose to go in black bloc, they were ended up being assaulted by police even when no violent actions had occurred. So that's sort of the question is, we had 4 million people around the world walk out on their jobs for this day of action. I think this is a really good thing, and it's going to bring a lot of attention to climate change as an issue. But even that many people skipping work, skipping school, hitting the streets, you know, it's not going to have any immediate effects on the largest polluters in the world today who are just going to continue business as usual.
Yeah, no, that was one of the very exciting things to hear about in the last week was International Trade Union Confederation said that it's 200 million members across the world were going to be also joining the climate strike. It was really cool to hear that there was that solidarity between students and the trade unions globally, but it will be interesting to see what comes out of it ultimately.
Yeah, and actions as far as protesting targeted areas, protesting pipelines, protesting at plants, like you can do demonstrations on the street and those are always really good. But I think the part of demonstration that needs to be kept in mind is disruption. Is you have to make yourself a truly disruptive force in the face of the kind of profits that you're fighting against. Because a lot of these people are so insulated and so indifferent to public outcry and public opinion that you're going to have to start messing with their money in order for them to start noticing. So I hope to see more disruptive action in the future. Either way, the cops are not really on anyone's side except for the status quo, so they'll mess with you anyway.
Speaking of direct actions, in eastern Kentucky and to some extent West Virginia, laid off miners have been striking and preventing mining companies' trains from leaving the mines after they were laid off without pay. The mining company Black Jewel, which has operations in Kentucky, West Virginia, Tennessee, and elsewhere, went bankrupt recently. However, they managed to pay out huge amounts of money to all the executives and partners of the company before declaring bankruptcy and dissolving, and leaving a bunch of miners completely unpaid, sometimes for work that they had already done. So what some of the miners have done is they simply set up camp and block the train tracks to stop the last loads of coal from leaving the station so that they can't make money off it. And so they've been having cookouts on the tracks, playing cornhole on the tracks. And the signs that they're waving say, "No pay, we stay." And so, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's a pretty small action because it is just a few affected miners stopping one train. But despite that, that's actually caused a fair amount of pressure on the owners of that company who need that revenue to wrap up and, you know, satisfy their debtors to some extent. So that's actually more of an effective tactic, actually hitting these companies where it hurts and affecting their ability to create profit that will actually get some action on the part of these companies, because they can ignore people in the streets. They, you know, they're up in their high towers or in their McMansions out in the woods, wherever the fuck rich people go. They don't have to care about it. So I think that really the heart of a strike is the industrial action of stopping production, of stopping the generation of profit.
Yeah, absolutely. Withholding labor is our number one weapon here, and we need to be using that as often as possible. Which, speaking of, the UAW strike is still going strong. Recently, they were visited by Elizabeth Warren, and so you have your various presidential candidates all looking to appear with the strike and appear in solidarity with the striking workers and everything. GM made a counter offer to the union, said to increase like profit sharing and stuff like that, trying to concede on some of those demands, but the union has rejected it on mainly on the grounds that there's nothing in the counter offer that includes temporary workers, and temporary workers are 10% of the workforce, and GM has often no plans to hire those people. They only want to keep their legacy workers on. It seems like their plan is to make the legacy jobs, make the established worker jobs as cushy as possible to try and appease the union, but just hire a bunch of temporary workers for what they call quote-unquote flexibility, which is just kind of par for the course as far as what industry standards are right now in tons of different sectors, where you just have a bunch of people hiring temporary workers that they don't have to pay that well, they don't have to give any benefits to. They can deal with really high turnover rate because, you know, here we are, a millennial generation, essentially being told that we're unemployable and we'll only ever be temporary workers anywhere we go.
And so the argument that the UAW workers are making is that the legacy workers in particular, like, are reasonably well compensated. But the issue is that they're not hiring more of these full-time positions,
exactly.
You know, only if they absolutely require them. And I think that the union has realized that the long-term plan is to replace all of these long-term full-time positions and replacing them with these part-time temporary workers who have no rights, who can't organize, firing them before they build enough skills or enough experience to ask for a raise, and essentially taking it back to pre-union organizing conditions by abusing the loopholes in the laws that have been created to disempower unions and just exploiting those as much as they can to make it impossible for folks to organize. And GM is really playing hardball there. What they ended up doing was withdrawing insurance coverage from all of the striking workers for the duration of the strike, which means that all of the health insurance payments for all these workers are being paid out of the strike fund through the COBRA program, which is insanely expensive because it's essentially the union is covering the full cost of the premium at this point. So what GM is doing is they're attempting to bleed out the UAW strike fund and basically take away people's health insurance as a threat. Oh, you want to withhold your labor? Well, we're going to withhold your health care, and then if you get sick, you're screwed, especially some of these legacy workers who are older. So GM's really coming out and trying to play hardball with people, and we'll see how it goes. Right now, the UAW is holding strong, and they do have that political support from Warren, from Sanders. They've gotten rhetorical support from other Democratic candidates, but I think that these workers really need our solidarity. Even if a lot of people in these industries are conservative, I think that socialist groups should absolutely go out and support the UAW at this point, because at the core of it, they are arguing that GM is making too much money and not sharing it with the workforce, which is absolutely the core point of what we need to change. We need to change the income and wealth distribution in this country, and helping strikes like this be successful is a small part of that.
Yeah, if you're anywhere near that area, I'd say absolutely jump on that. There are definite bridges to be built there.
If I could point out maybe two things about one thing that I believe the company is trying to do by benefiting the union workers really well is they're genuinely creating it so that it's in the union workers' best interest to get theirs and be class traitors in essence and throw the rights of the other people under the bus. And it is astounding to me that not only have they seen through this tactic, but that they're continuing to stand in the with the generation of maybe younger or ununionized workers already. So big props to them for that. The other thing is that with the presidential candidates supporting these strikes and supporting these unions, what we're not only seeing is that they are principled on this matter, but also that they believe that the electorate is principled enough on this matter to have that benefit them and not be spending their political capital by supporting these unions, but generating a sort of momentum with that support. And I think that's really good. And if we reward them for that, and if we see that follow through, I think we can not only get some bottom-up action with supporting labor, but we might actually be able to generate some momentum from the top down.
Absolutely. So you did some research on the recent strikes in Kaiser Permanente, right?
A very small amount. They're actually set to strike in October. There's been some actions up through the past little while, but the main thing is about 80,000 workers in a, you know, conglomerate of unions or a coalition of unions are set to strike beginning, I believe it was, October 14th. And given that this is all one industry, that will be the largest strike since the 90s with the Postal Workers Union, which was 120-some or 140-some, I believe. Yeah, there's been a lot of questions, you know, oh, how are patients going to get care and everything? Just the rhetorical smear strategy of trying to paint the striking workers as the bad guys and, like, who's going to do this job that's necessary? But obviously, if they're undercompensated, if you're not getting new workers there, if they can't perform their jobs, then a temporary strike is what's necessary to rejuvenate the industry and make it function as planned.
Yeah, earlier this year, there was a strike on the part of specifically mental health care workers under Kaiser, and they went on strike not, like, they did have some pay demands, but the company had already agreed to most of that. But what they went on strike was they were asking the company to hire more mental health care workers because the existing staff was stretched too thin. Like, the wait lines for people were extending into, you know, over a month for people to get mental health care. And if somebody's having a crisis and they ask for an appointment and it takes them a month to get it, like, that's a problem. So these workers were going on strike specifically to help the customers who needed their services, to ask not for more benefits for themselves, but for more coworkers to help deal with their work. And to my understanding, that strike did not achieve the results that they wanted because it was just that one segment of the workforce. But to my understanding, I believe that the Kaiser mental health care workers are also going to be going on strike as a part of this new action in October. And hopefully with it being a not just a segment of Kaiser's workforce, but a large slice of their healthcare workers all going on strike at the same time, that might be able to put a bit more pressure on the company and pressure it to, you know, actually invest in these fields. Because this isn't even an issue of, like, profit sharing. This is a matter of Kaiser is not putting in the resources that it needs to do what Kaiser exists to do.
Yeah, well, it's actually one of, it's a really big issue just in the clinical psychology space in general, is that a lot of people who are working in these care facilities, they are some of the most burnt out, just, like, regardless of what their compensation is, it's never enough because their mental health is taking a toll dealing with the amount of stress that they are engaging with every day on the job.
Yeah, and when you get down to it, they're not striking for higher wages, they're striking to reduce the stress of their workload. And they're basically striking for each other. Even the fact that the mental health care workers aren't going on strike in the way that they have shows that their motivations are fundamentally rooted in solidarity rather than strictly self-interest.
It's a pretty common thing in a lot of industries right now where people are just flat out not hiring actual employees. They just want to cycle through these temp workers, just like with GM, just like with everyone else. It's just, it's all about the gig economy right now. And they're definitely seeing that and profiting off of it.
So, obviously I stand Bernie Sanders, but I do have to say that the one good idea that Buttigieg has had so far is he has a plan to unionize gig economy workers. And you know that this is a good plan because there's an article in Reason magazine saying that it will destroy the gig economy. So if the libertarians hate it, then it's probably a good idea. I think something that a lot of people don't really fully realize is that the gig economy, this economy of people working for apps, essentially doing peace labor for these companies like Uber and Lyft, they, quote, create value, unquote. The way that they work is by reducing their labor costs, by obfuscating the relationship between the worker and the value that they create, in order for the company to extract more of the financial value out of that labor than the workers would otherwise receive. If you're a zero-hour contract worker and you cause trouble for the company, they can just not give you any hours. If you do a lot of labor for them, they can just cap your pay, or they can take an unreasonable percentage of it, and you can't renegotiate that contract because they have all the bargaining power. Gig economy workers, contract workers, don't have the right to unionize. And there's really no justification for that, because work is work, labor is labor. And there's no reason why someone who's working under a contract shouldn't have the same rights to unionize as someone who's working under traditional salaried or a traditional wage employment situation. Like the carve out for contract workers in not having the right to unionize, when that was originally made as a compromise with the unions back in the 50s, that compromise existed so that independent, self-employed people could essentially operate as a small business, as a contractor, rather than, you know, having to get into a wage relationship. It was essentially a way of preventing contractors from unionizing inappropriately. But now the definition of contractor has been stretched to this point where you have some person who's essentially acting as a taxi, using their own vehicle as a taxi to ferry people around, which is an actual job, but they're being treated the same way that a self-employed contractor would be, because technically it's a zero-hour contract and it's not, technically, they're not employed by Uber, they're not employed by Lyft, you know, they're not employed by DoorDash or whichever company they're working for. And so the whole gig economy, that whole sector, pretty much exists as a way to screw over workers. If you have a job for one of these app companies, you're being fucked.
That's absolutely true, and that's why it's so exciting to see the kind of political action on that front, where there's talk of a bill that I believe has actually passed.
Yes.
Of contractors, especially those under Uber and Lyft, being considered actual employees of those companies, where they can unionize, they get a lot of the same benefits, you know, they don't get screwed over nearly as hard. It's nice to see that at least some legislators are paying some amount of attention to how hard workers are being screwed over right now.
Yeah, and it's really important to remember that unions aren't just for, like, again, air quotes, skilled labor. Unions are for all workers. The whole division between skilled and unskilled labor was invented to divide the workforce and prevent people from having solidarity with each other. Like, workers in fast food and retail and the gig economy and grocery stores and every place else have just as much of a right to unionize as anyone else, and they need to exercise that right, because right now workers in this country are getting a raw-ass deal, and people need to use their rights as much as possible. And it's not easy. It is a struggle, but it's a struggle that will pay out in the long run. If you don't struggle, you'll never win. So speaking of grocery stores, Ellie, I believe you.
Yeah. So I was looking into what's happening with the Fred Meyer stores in Oregon and Southwest Washington, where in their negotiations, the workers were wanting better pay. And apparently somewhere in there, the Fred Meyer company started pulling people in to have one-on-one meetings, which was being seen as like an intimidation tactic. And so the reason why this is a big issue is that that goes directly against federal labor laws. So after these one-on-one meetings were taking place, the union filed a grievance with the National Labor Relations Board, but that might not get ruled on for months. And so in the meantime, the Fred Meyer employees have just dropped all contracts and are currently calling for a boycott of Fred Meyer products and stores, and are still working, but they're working without a contract. And while they have been approved to go on strike eventually, they have not called for one yet. But it was funny because when a spokesman for Fred Meyer was asked about all of this, he was saying that it was going to negatively impact the employees and their families because it might push customers to other non-union stores. And it's like, wait, that's not... That's the point of a boycott. What point do you think that you're making, sir? But yeah, so everything is still under negotiation and has been going since June 2018. So it's been going on a while, but it's unclear when things will start really coming to a head.
Yeah, but in the meantime, if they're calling for a boycott, that means boycott. You know, picket lines aren't just picket lines with signs, you know. If they're asking you not to boycott, then don't cross that picket line either.
I know their selection of soda is impressive, but there are way better places, I promise. We can find it together, comrades. We can find the best soda fountains. Yeah, California's been pretty exciting lately as far as bills that have been passed lately. For example, there's the one about private prisons. Private prisons are going to be hit very hard in California because of some bill. I believe that they're just outright banned now, which is super exciting because it's nice to see at least one state in our United States take a stand against slavery.
Well, you say that, but we still have inmates going out and working as firefighters for $1 a day.
No, it's true. That was mostly just a joke. You know?
No,
it was like, haha, sure. Can you imagine if one of our states didn't have slaves in it? That would be funny. Anyway, yeah, it's nice to see them at least probably 5 or 6 years too late, but at least finally hear the public about, hey, private prisons are really bad, they're super crowded, they're extremely dangerous, they go through all these labor violations, like, it's absurdly inhumane what happens there. There's that saying, you know, what happens in California kind of eventually happens everywhere else in the states. It's nice to see at least that kind of stand happen.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because if you look at the book of California labor law, it is giant. It is like 2 to 3 inches thick, whereas if you look at the ones for other states, they're like maybe less than an inch thick. It's one of those things where the California labor laws are just so intricate that it's interesting to see how those start impacting other states that have looser lines around what they can and can't do. But, you know, still got at least the National Labor Relations Act to keep most companies in check.
Yeah, although the Trump administration is doing what they can to undermine the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Bureau, by essentially underfunding it and forcing them to lengthen their queues to process unions' complaints and requests.
Yeah, it sucks because the board is actually in part proposed by the president and confirmed by Congress, I think. And so whoever we get next is going to make a big impact there.
Yeah, I'm excited for The Jungle Part 2, now that all the slaughterhouses are becoming deregulated. Because you can really just expect them to regulate themselves, you know. Only one person fell into the meat grinder this month. It's, you know,
minimum acceptable levels.
Yeah, yeah.
This pork guaranteed to have, you know, maximum length. On average.
Long pork returns to shelves.
I do want to go back a little bit to the private prisons and incarcerated workers. I do want to sort of harp on the point that private prisons are the worst aspect of our prison system, but everything else is also really, really bad. You know, obviously everything in prison is, even if it's a publicly owned prison, all the services nowadays are largely provided by private contractors that charge the inmates ridiculous amounts of money to use the phone to call their families or even to call their lawyer, removing prison libraries and replacing them with tablets that you have to pay to access books or news, forcing inmates to pay for their essential sanitary items, like especially in women's prisons, people who need menstrual products being forced essentially to work just to get pads or tampons, which is just absolutely inhumane. So the IWW has a program through their Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee that does a lot of good work trying to coordinate with people on the inside to help them organize for better conditions in the prisons. But obviously it's very difficult because obviously the guards and the prison administration have a lot of power to just shut whatever the inmates are doing down because they really have very few rights. It's possible for us to contribute to their struggle from the outside by putting pressure on the companies that provide these services or the companies that run private prisons. I think one thing a lot of people don't really realize, if you're working for a company that has a 401k or some sort of profit sharing investment system, if you work for a company that has that sort of setup in some degree or another, your retirement may be invested in a company that runs private prisons or that gouges inmates providing services to these prisons. You can pressure your company to divest from these unethical corporations and essentially stop investing in their stock, cause their stock to fall because of the unethical practices of those businesses. If you make a stink within your company, especially if you have a union, you can put pressure on them to withdraw from that and maybe put some pressure on those unethical companies to be slightly less shitty. Again, it's an indirect action, but considering how difficult it is to work with, you know, incarcerated workers without having, you know, deeper connections to it, that's probably the best avenue of support for now.
This is making me want to talk about no ethical consumption. When we're in the position that we're in right now, it's kind of like you have to do what you can. We have so little power that we kind of have to flex whatever abilities we do have. Sometimes I've done this also where you kind of fall into the trap of saying, well, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism, therefore I'm not really responsible for my choices and stuff. But we have seen shifts in markets because of consumer choices. Even if people at the top are slow to react to public opinion, they still are eventually reacting to it. And things like boycotts, things like not participating in certain industries, you know, not buying certain products, all that kind of stuff, all the aspects of a boycott, they really do have an impact. It might not be a massive impact, but this is something I've kind of turned around on a little bit. I feel like you have some responsibility, even as just a consumer and not even necessarily an activist, to consume according to your ethics and according to your morals, because the market can change, these things can change even with very small actions, you know. So I think that that's something that we as socialists, yes, there's no ethical consumption, as in there are no good choices, but we should still be making the best choices we can.
Yeah, absolutely. And the idea of boycotting as a method of activism is like fundamentally neoliberal, I guess. But at the same time, it is a tactic that can have effects, and we need to use every tool in our toolbox if we want to enact change. So my advice would be, don't rely on boycotts as a method of political action. I mean, how many people have been boycotting Chick-fil-A for God knows how long, and they haven't changed their actions one bit aside from some PR, the homophobic chicken. But the boycott is sort of like the minimum acceptable level of activism. That is literally the least you can do. If there's a company that is being especially shitty, the least you can do is try not to buy from them. And obviously all of these companies are shitty, so the question is, obviously you can't avoid all of them. Like, try boycotting Nestle. It's almost impossible. They have a million brands, they have a million different products. It's very hard to boycott them without completely changing all of your consumption habits. And then if you also want to boycott all the other terrible companies, you're going to have a bad time. There is no ethical consumption under capitalism. But what you can do is you can target your boycotts, and especially if it's part of a coordinated, targeted action. So, for instance, if the Fred Meyer employees go on strike, if they go outside and they picket outside of Fred Meyer's stores, and if all of the people in that area boycott those stores, the combination of all three of those actions is likely to be powerful enough to force the company to come to the bargaining table and negotiate, at least to some extent, in good faith. The combination of multiple tactics coming together, focusing on a single point of struggle, is how you enact change. Hundreds of thousands of people passively boycotting different things that matter to them a little bit more or a little bit less, it's such a diffuse action that it's not going to have the really powerful effects that we want to make change. Boycotts need to be a targeted action in coordination with labor actions, with industrial actions, to actually put the pressure on as part of a broader strategy. So I guess what I'm saying is, no ethical consumption or capitalism, but boycotts are very good in conjunction with other tactics.
Yeah, definitely. And don't buy their shit and then set it on fire. Oh, like God, those no. fucking man children on the right. Like, they only care about money. Like, the people who run these companies, they only ever will ever care about money. That's it. So if you're buying their product and setting it on fire, they're like, okay, but you bought it, so...
Yeah, and the way that these companies try to fight back against boycotts is by turning it into a culture war issue. Oh, look, the liberals are mad at Chick-fil-A. Oh, how about all us conservatives go stick it to them by buying chicken sandwiches? Or it goes the other way. Oh, look, Gillette made an ad that made a bunch of conservatives mad. I guess all the liberals have to go buy Gillette now. You have to really separate out which of these sorts of things are contrived by these companies as a marketing tool to try to appeal to different segments of the culture war versus which of these things originate in the labor movement, which of these are actual labor actions that need our support. Again, you can't boycott every company. If you're going to do a boycott, you need to focus it on a company where workers are actually struggling to make reforms in that company.
Yeah. If the company is saying it, if it's sponsored by the company, don't listen to a fucking word. Like, anything sponsored by a company is marketing by the company. They only care about whether or not you're going to spend money there, or whether or not your reaction to it is going to make someone else spend money there. That's the only thing that matters.
Yeah, or if it's like an obviously inflammatory ad that's designed to piss off a certain segment of the public and to make other people laugh at them. Like, again, like with Gillette, like with Chick-fil-A, like with all these other, again, culture war issues, just be aware that that is manufactured. That happened on accident once, and ever since then, like, Nike got on board with it. Gillette got on board with it. Marvel, to some extent, with Captain Marvel and things like that. These companies are playing you and trying to get you to consume their product by pissing off other people that you don't like. So don't fall for it, because, you know, in the end, they're just going to fuck you over. Or at the very least, they'll fuck their employees over, and then you'll be culpable for that.
Yep. I do know that California is planning on passing rent control, which is a huge deal for everyone there, because that was something that we fought really hard for, and that's an essential part of the type of voice that we want American workers to have in their daily lives. You know, obviously we want some amount of say in what happens even in our homes, and when it's so blatantly obvious, when gentrification is happening, when it's so obvious that communities are being pushed out to build gigantic empty lofts, then we need things like rent control to actually battle against that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we fought pretty hard for rent control last year. We fought for Prop 10, which was the proposition ballot plebiscite version of this bill that ended up getting shot down mostly by homeowning people in wealthy parts of LA and San Francisco, and obviously a lot of conservatives in the rural areas. California is a lot more conservative than a lot of people realize in some pretty negative ways. So it's really cool to see that the legislature took the initiative and actually passed a rent control bill that does tie it to inflation rather than simply allowing these scumbag, massive conglomerate landlord companies that everyone that I know pays their rent to. There's this sort of myth of the small landlord, and there's like a few of those around. But so many people in California, so much of their income, so much of their pay goes to these massive corporations that just bought up a bunch of land and a bunch of houses during the housing crisis. It's really good to see some sort of action from the California legislature, but obviously there's so much more that we need to do. There's been a resurgence in California of tenants unions in Los Angeles, in like Pomona, in Orange County. There's all these tenants unions springing up, getting people organized to fight back against scumbag landlords. And that's really encouraging to see. And I would encourage, if you're still relatively new to leftist politics, maybe you're involved with the SRA or the DSA to some extent, but you want to find local actions that you can really get involved in, I would highly recommend looking to see if there are any local tenants unions, or if you can establish a tenants union, or at least, you know, some sort of tenants rights organization to fight back against scumbag landlords. Because aside from people's bosses and people's employers, the landlord-renter relationship is one of the most imbalanced, ethically fraught, exploitative relationships in our society today. And I think it's a really key point of struggle for people. Well, I think we're going to take a quick break for a musical interlude. After the break, we're going to try to get Rowdy ranting about something.
Yeah.
Back, folks. Tonight we're going to have an interview with my comrade Rowdy, who has some interesting thoughts on the philosophy of ideology. And I think we're going to have a pretty interesting discussion here today. So go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Rowdy. I identify myself on Twitter at Recursive Signs, pansexual, nihilist, socialist. I have a degree in mathematics. And I don't really believe that humans can know truth in a way that we would find very satisfying.
That's pretty counterintuitive, because a lot of people are really wedded to the idea of truth and facts and knowing things. Like, everybody wants to base their decisions on things that they believe are true. So why don't you think that we can really know what's true, and how does that affect the way you think?
The first error I think people make when they talk about truth is not having a strong grasp of the differences between what we imagine to be a physical fact and what we believe to be true in an abstract sense. This has actually been bolstered by my study of mathematics, learning the shaky foundations on which our notions of addition or how we perceive basic contradiction, as well as alternative logic models, makes me heavily reconsider different kinds of thought, perception, and the construction of belief.
So I know in mathematics, you hear sometimes about mathematicians saying that I believe in a God because I believe that these systems of mathematics must have some divine basis, that this must have been created. And you take sort of the opposite stance of that, of this is something that we've created ourselves to understand things, and we can only really understand the system that we've created to describe what we observe, rather than this being some inherent fundamental fact of the universe.
That's correct. When we have multiple models of abstracted understanding that all come from a different basis, are all, as far as we can tell, internally consistent, and all reach a variety of different conclusions within different contexts, it feels somewhat arbitrary to say that we have selected the right one, that it's an accurate model of the way our reality exists. And this kind of thinking, while not the basis necessarily for a more broad epistemic nihilism, is paralleled in that.
You also have the sort of scientific naturalist sort of people who say, okay, well, yes, our scientific theories and our mathematical theorems are just descriptions, they're systems that we've created, but we can arrive at a more perfect description through experimentation and observation. If we can't have truth, we can at least asymptotically approach truth as we discover more things. Isn't there some value in that?
I don't believe it's necessarily incorrect. I view that point of view as incredibly valuable. Not only is it one that I'd feel comfortable ascribing to myself, but probably one that I feel is most useful. The issue comes with confusing that approach or that method of modeling physical existence with a metaphysical truth or some sort of deeper knowledge that really sticks in my craw, so to speak. And I wouldn't have as much of a problem with it if so many people didn't have extremely strict, extremely literal views of knowing, believing, truth, that sort of business.
Especially when you have, like, popular science figures that are really sloppy with their epistemology, where you have, like, Richard Dawkins or Neil deGrasse Tyson or any of these sort of new atheist types that do take this, at least in the way that they talk about things, I don't know what they think privately, but at least in the way that they talk about things, it's this very absolutist, naturalist, this is the way the universe works, and if you don't think this, then you're just an idiot. Like, there's some validity in that. Obviously, if you're a flat earther or something, stop. But, you know, it seems like science is a really useful tool, but the way that it's actually used a lot can often lead people to having more confidence in what they believe than is really merited. Would you say that's fair?
I'd say that's absolutely fair. The main thing in modern scientific thinking, as opposed to earlier kinds of overconfident dogmatism, is obviously the attempted reference to external reality and the method of attaining consensus. All of these things are very good, but most people I've talked to, including most people with science degrees up to and including PhDs, most people with math degrees up to and including PhDs, have very little philosophy of science or philosophy of mathematics or really history of the progress of science or the progress of mathematics from ancient Babylonian or ancient Sumerian societies, which properly show how these kinds of knowledge can fit within larger frameworks, or where they can be making pretty fundamental errors on an ideological or philosophical front.
Absolutely. So far we've been sort of abstract talking about this in the sort of philosophy of science, you know, philosophy of science sense, but the idea that truth is not something that we can necessarily know or is necessarily something that exists, I think, is a really relevant concept in the era of hashtag fake news, especially in this social media soaked society that we live in now, where people are cloistered off into their own little bubbles of the news that they want to hear, of the opinions that they want to listen to. Your concept of truth is really based on things that you observe, and if the things that you observe are limited to a small subset of the larger things that are happening in the world, then that has some pretty serious implications for understanding how our ideologies form and are shaped, whether you be, you know, a liberal, a conservative, a socialist, or a neo-Nazi.
That is absolutely true, and it's something I and hopefully everyone has grappled with at some point in time, is the narrowness of their view. Part of the issue that I also encounter and deal with in my thinking on this matter is the sheer breadth of issues that a person has to be informed on in order to make reasonable decisions. For example, which tendency should I ascribe to? Given that you believe on a very fundamental level that people should not be homeless, you find yourself among leftist circles very often. Choosing at that point whether to be an anarcho-communist or a Marxist-Leninist will depend on your socialization, the kind of evidence you see, your view of history, and your view of the world as it is now. There's so much data and so much discourse that it's almost impossible for a single person to engage with all of these to any degree that you would hope to be satisfactory.
Yeah, I mean, I've put together a pretty solid library of leftist thought, and I follow all kinds of current news, and I've read all sorts of history, but even I feel like I have just this very sort of limited view of what brought the world to its current point. And I arrived at this view through learning more, through learning things that they don't teach in history classes about the labor movement or about communism or the rise of fascism. And learning those things has shaped my worldview. So I guess the question is, what is the value in describing yourself with a certain ideological label if you know for a fact that you are making a decision about your value system based on a very incomplete data set?
Well, one thing that I ascribe to as I began describing myself as a socialist, and which is still largely true to this day, is if I were able to make or influence society to go as far left as possible in any tendency, I would be closer to what I feel is a good system than if I acted in any other manner. So It's a sort of Pascal's wager where you'll believe in an ideology in a contingent manner in order to achieve good results. And there's a bit of pragmatism in there in the sense of the philosophical school of pragmatism. Truth is utility, in other words. But there's also a sort of, not necessarily giving up, but a certain recognition that good enough is good enough, and believing that you can't know truth allows you to interface with the limited knowledge that you have in a way that still manages to be productive. If you're seeking an unattainable goal to the exclusion of a good enough, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, and that's why I always encourage people to read more theory. I always encourage people to read more history. But at the other time, if you try to read all of the theory and all of the history, then, well, first off, you're going to fail. But second, you're just going to end up as an academic, and you'll never be able to put the things that you're reading into practice, because you'll always be waiting for that one more bit of knowledge, that one more bit of information, or that one idea that you're hoping will tie everything together and make it into a unified, consistent whole that you can say, yes, I know for a fact that this is the true ideology, that this is the correct way that things should be done. If you're always waiting for more information to come to that point, then you're never going to be able to put your ideology into praxis. And you don't need to know that your ideology is 100% correct in order for that ideology to have utility as a tool that you can apply to try to make the world a better place.
Absolutely. That's a fantastic way of saying it. So we've talked about my epistemic nihilism, but the reason I throw it out just as nihilist is because I am also, to a very real degree, a moral nihilist. I don't believe that goodness exists outside of human experience, and even that is subjective and on a per-person basis. Now, we obviously see many people who claim themselves to be moral nihilists end up as Nazis, end up as fascists, end up as serial killers. And it's important to say that believing that there is no goodness in reality should not compel you to perform what you consider to be evil in any way, shape, or form.
That's a decision that those people are making, perhaps on selfish or aesthetic grounds, rather than the absence of good does not imply that one must be evil.
Yes, and admitting that you yourself are a nihilist takes away any sort of moral high ground wherein you can appeal to something objective to condemn their actions. And I think a lot of people refuse nihilism because of this, because they want to be able to say, no, there's a reason outside of myself that I am right and they are wrong. But you don't need that. You don't need that to be able to disagree with someone, to have principles, and to act in a way that you yourself believe to be correct.
But that does, you know, raise the question, if you don't believe there is such a thing as inherent good or bad, then how does one come to the decision of saying that homelessness is a bad thing that should be done away with, that people should have homes? How does one come to the conclusion that inequality is bad if there is no fundamental moral basis in which to make those decisions?
I believe it's also a recognition of the fact that we are already reaching those decisions without an objective truth, and we're following a very natural impulse towards compassion. The human mind is not merely a blank slate. As many New Atheists have pointed out, we already have the impulses towards goodness. Hitchens, despicable as he was in many regards, famously said, "I've murdered exactly the number of people that I've wanted to, which is zero." I believe that was him. If not, it was another New Atheist thinker. We're all following a variety of impulses, and taking away your authority to objectively say that you are reaching the right conclusions doesn't negate those impulses in your principle or in your action. We operate the same way in a world without objectivity as we operate in a world with objectivity, in the sense that we can still institute laws and we can still come to a consensus on what we believe is right. We're merely removing external notions of what a human being can value, or that we will all reach the same conclusions.
But then what leads to the people who do make that decision that because there is no universal good or universal bad, that they can simply engage in asocial behavior, where we do get our neo-Nazis, our eco-fascists, our, you know, serial killers, and just the sort of stereotype of the evil moral nihilist. Where does that sort of person come from if we do have these impulses towards cooperation and solidarity?
I don't believe that the impulses towards cooperation and solidarity are universal. I don't believe that they are equally present in every person. I'm much more open to the breadth of human experience, what a human being can be, either physically, mentally. I don't believe in the spirit, but I know many people do. I don't believe that you can change these people. I don't believe that anyone has been able to, or that you need necessarily try. You can't convince someone to feel a certain way with reason, and I don't believe that you ever have been able to. Reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions, in other words. But I believe what society has done and what it will need to continue to do is to curb these impulses with force the same way we always have. The notion that you shouldn't use force unless it is in response to a direct threat is still valuable, but I don't believe a pacifist outlook will ever be good because you will still have these people, and I believe that being able to put forth your own impulses in a consensus manner, being able to put forth your compassion into action in a non-pacifistic way will always be necessary in order to curb those impulses. You're never going to train these people to believe in an objective good or get them to see the light of an objective good if you don't believe that's real. What you're left with is a materialist analysis of how you stop them or how you correct that sort of behavior.
Now, not to be sectarian about it, but it does sound like there's sort of an implicit critique of anarchism there. So much of anarchist theory, especially if you read people like Emma Goldman and the others who came from that sort of proto-existentialist tradition, there's this sort of belief that comes through in their writings of the desire for human beings to express their inner goodness and the creativity of their souls, or if not their souls, then at least their personalities, to express that to its fullest extent. If there are people who, because of whatever factor, whether it be inherent or environmental, who have these antisocial impulses, who can never necessarily be convinced not to be that way, then how can an anarchist society based on consensus and cooperation really deal with that sort of person without some sort of authoritarianism?
I'll be frank, I haven't read much anarchist literature, and I find myself consistently perplexed by how it deals with things like this. My understanding will be incomplete, and I'm going to have implicit critiques that may well and should have been answered by these thinkers. I don't believe they were stupid. I don't believe anarchists who follow them were stupid. I believe they do have answers. I just don't know them.
All right, sorry to put you on the spot there.
Oh no, absolutely. This is one of my good friends is an anarchist, and I look forward to seeing him in person again soon so that he can explain some of the different aspects of theory to me.
Awesome. So one thing that I sort of want to talk about is the malleability of ideology. And this is something that's been on my mind recently because I've become aware of a number of people who I've interacted with in the past, or that I have friends or social media friends that know these people, who have gone from being anarchists to being eco-fascists, which on its surface seems like a complete reversal of fundamental values. Going from someone who rejects all authority, who at least in theory advocates for cooperation and solidarity, moving to a mindset where they're willing to advocate for the destruction of current society, for the implementation of a authoritarian state to protect a small minority. So I guess the question is, in your view, how can someone make such a radical change in ideology, going from an anti-authoritarian stance to being an eco-fascist?
While I haven't known anyone who has made this jump directly, one thing I'd say I believe converts people to an eco-fascist mindset would be the introduction of materialism and the bleakness of the human condition at its current moment into their thought. If someone is an idealist and they believe that people cooperating together or forming contracts in a just manner will lead to an ideal society, being confronted with the necessity for immediate top-down action in order to confront the existential threat of climate change may override their principles of cooperation in the face of physical evidence and encourage not simply a reversal on the notion of liberty, but an utter demand for the lack of liberty in order to prevent existential death of the human race. I don't think in any way, shape, or form that this is correct, but I can kind of see why someone would make that leap. I do find myself leaning more towards authoritarian leftism, more towards state socialism in order to confront these issues, but I believe that if we commit an industrialized or deliberate genocide or allow a deliberate genocide to be committed, that's really not even worthwhile. If it would save the human species, I don't believe it would in the first place. I think any sort of attempt to that would be not only morally reprehensible, once again, I'm appealing to my own sense of morality, but that's all that any of us can have. I hope you agree with me, but also materially unfeasible.
And I will say that that is one of the reasons that I don't commit to being an anarchist, despite having very strong anti-authoritarian tendencies, is how do we deal with these massive socio-political problems? How do we change the entire world's systems of production and consumption to mitigate this looming crisis without having some sort of large-scale coordinated effort to make those changes happen? And I don't see any way that that can happen purely from individuals and small groups making decisions in their local communities alone. That seems like the sort of thing, a problem that large needs some sort of large system in place to deal with it. And I don't like states, but in order to solve a problem like that, you need to be able to commit large amounts of capital to solving that problem, and you need some sort of structure to accumulate and direct that capital. Even if that sort of accumulation of capital is in itself authoritarian and leads to the concentration of power is in and of itself a useful tool for getting things done. That is what power is, whether it be economic, financial, military, societal, or whatever. So, I don't know.
I don't either. Like I said, I'm mostly going along a good enough scale of working towards the end of homelessness, hunger, and universal healthcare. I believe that even a socially democratic society would mostly be details away from my ideal one, rather than one which permits and perpetuates imperialism as well as extreme poverty.
Absolutely. So I guess the question, going back to the eco-fascists, is there anything that we maybe could do to, if not deconvert the people who have gone to that sort of extremism, is there a way that we can approach these issues that might inoculate people against that sort of swing towards fascism and towards exclusionary politics? And beyond just eco-fascism, like you see it also with the dirtbag left, who we've criticized on this podcast often, how do you stop people from going down that path when they at least nominally accept ideas of social inclusion and solidarity, but then direct hate or derision towards specific groups and argue that we shouldn't necessarily look towards their needs in particular?
I'm not sure how you would compel or inoculate or convince people of acceptance of diversity within one functioning society, but I believe that you can inoculate against eco-fascism with a materialist point of view. One of the greatest contributors to climate change and to the destruction of the natural environment, as I'm sure no one is surprised to hear, is the military-industrial complex itself. The operation, production, and maintenance of the war machine uses huge amounts of resources and puts out huge amounts of pollutants. So the use of this, the expansion of this, in order to try and reduce the number of consumers on the whole is hysterically bad. And apart from that, what we will find ourselves at war with is other nuclear powers. And oh boy, nuclear winter and climate change do not cancel each other out. They absolutely do not. So while maybe you can't totally convince someone away from a discompassionate close the borders mindset, which places the abstraction of nationhood above the well-being of people, you can't necessarily convince someone away from that with this argument. You can convince them away from perpetuating or starting imperialist wars And I believe once you've convinced them of this premise, you can get them to agree that a global reduction in poverty and resource scarcity will limit conflict around the world, especially among those nations most affected by the destruction of the climate.
And I think that's something that's really important that needs to be brought up, is the solution to climate change has to involve some level of climate justice, of compensating the people who are most harmed by this, which globally is the poor in the global south, which is to some extent the poor of every nation, who, because capitalism insulates the wealthy and the powerful from the consequences of climate change and most other things. But I think one thing that a lot of people don't really take into account is the necessity for what some people call degrowth, right? The idea that we have to reduce our standard of living, that we have to reduce the level of consumption in the West in order to create the room in our carbon budget to allow the poverty stricken around the world to maintain some basic level of living, rather than having us impose this imperialism on others to sustain our unsustainable way of life. So I guess the question is, how do you convince someone that they should consume less, that they should accept a lower standard of living, especially in a capitalist society where everything is focused around personal satisfaction and the accumulation of wealth and this idea of like eternal growth, as Greta Thunberg criticized at the UN? How do you sell John, the flag-waving, pickup-truck-driving conservative from Alabama, how do you convince him that he needs to consume less in order for the world to be saved?
I don't know that you can. I believe an economic restructuring is vital and completely 100% necessary in order to reform the consumption that we have. People talk about the carbon output of developing, so to speak, nations, while ignoring our import of manufactured goods. This is the consumption that we have. Our carbon numbers are lying when they say that we can continue to consume at this level.
Like when people talk about, oh, well, look at how much China is polluting compared to the US. So much of China's pollution and so much of China's carbon output comes from the production of consumer goods for the West.
Yes.
And I feel like I do have to like criticize myself there, because earlier I commented on describing a person who would have to reduce their consumption. I described a Southern conservative, and that is like a stereotype, because a lot of consumption does come from the ruling class, does come from the bourgeoisie, especially in the West, who have frankly ludicrous levels of carbon consumption, especially anyone who flies a private jet. I do want to point out that those people do have the most to cut. Those are the people who are behaving most unethically in a climactic sense. But it's also important to remember that everyone in the West is going to have to make some concessions. This isn't solely the responsibility of the wealthy. There's a meme that goes around, and I enjoy it. It's a good meme, but people say that 70% of the world's carbon emissions come from these 100 companies or whatever. That's true. But most of those companies emit that carbon making things that you consume. So I think that people take this valid critique of the wealthy and of large corporations as having the most responsibility for dealing with climate change, but then they use that as an excuse to offload responsibility from themselves and say, oh, well, there's no ethical consumption under capitalism. I don't need to change anything. It's just the wealthy that we need to guillotine, and then everything will be fine.
There are two methods of incentivization that we can employ, which is the hyper-specific, let's stop these 100 companies, and the structural, let's make it impossible to support this level of production and consumption. These companies could choose to stop producing, and they absolutely should to the degree that they are doing it, but we must structurally make it impossible for someone else to fulfill that role. And that necessarily means that we are not going to have these goods to consume.
I'm sorry, Funko Pops have to go.
Yeah, my computer upgrades as well. There's a line in a cyberpunk book called Snow Crash, and it states that a person's salary who lives in LA out of a you store it says that he makes what, I'm gonna try my best to quote exactly, but it's been a while. This person's wages are what a Pakistani bricklayer would consider good for a day's work. This line is meant to introduce some notion of, like, horror in the Western reader, but to a very real degree, that's kind of the hope, is a unification of the wealth and consumption of the working class around the world. That means raising the Pakistani bricklayer's salary, and that means lowering ours.
That's going to be a tough sell, especially in a society so infused with consumerist ideology as American society. I mean, we already have Trump threatening civil war over the specter of impeachment and people being willing to kill, maybe not willing to die, but willing to kill in Donald Trump's name. What's going to happen when we ask people to cut their consumption to meet the level of someone in, say, Eastern Europe, while we bring up Pakistan and sub-Saharan Africa and other underdeveloped places to those standards as well? Like, the necessity of doing that implies basically a civil war.
I believe we can reach that over time without violence. We see in the public presence of Greta Thunberg, we see in the discussions and postings of younger millennials, of Generation Z, the Zoomers, that once climate has stopped becoming an abstraction, the levels of sacrifice that people are finally willing to make are extreme. In the eco-fascist case, what they're willing to sacrifice is their sense of moral decency and their resistance to genocide. Instead, we must convince people that it is more necessary and much better to give up their goods.
But how do we square that with the Zoomers' intense desire to play Fortnite?
I think there's a way to make the current levels of computer gaming somewhat competitive without drastically increasing our carbon output. I think once we stop releasing new iPhones, maybe we just optimize the production of one or two. Sorry, everybody, you can't get all the different name brand phones.
That's a fair point, and we don't necessarily need 50 different models of crossover SUV. So, we're running a little long on time, so I guess I sort of want to give you the floor. If there's one sort of philosophical or ethical consideration that you think that people should keep in mind as they apply their ideology to the world around them to try to make the world a better place, is there any sort of thought that you want people to keep in mind in the way that they do that?
I would say when you have a disagreement with someone, you should consider, in a way, what are my legitimate and what are my illegitimate enemies. If you are a hard Marxist-Leninist, if your conflict with an anarchist is due to something 70 years old or something that may happen in a more perfect reality, that is an illegitimate enemy. That's not a conflict that has real bearing on what you're doing or how you're living, or what they're doing or how they're living. You can have a common goal for the next 20 years and never have a problem. And by then, you might not even have a conflict anymore with each other. But the person next door who hates people of other races, who hates gay people, who is voting against them or making threats online, that is a legitimate enemy, and you don't need to appeal to some universal good or some universal ill to be able to say that you can oppose them with your principles 100% of the way.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Do you have anything that you want to plug? Anything, any projects that you're working on that you think people should take a look at?
Yes. I'm currently doing a weekly live stream where for about 2 hours every Saturday, this last one was a bit off, I've been reading Capital by Karl Marx while playing a tower defense game called Bloons Tower Defense 6. I'm going to keep that up for a while. After I finish volumes 1 through 3 of Capital, whenever that comes, I'm going to be reading Settlers next. I hear that one's pretty good.
Nice. Well, again, thank you so much for coming on, and I hope people take something away from this conversation. Solidarity.
Goodbye.